Is it ever okay for a Christian to tell a lie? Can a Christian pastor be a spy? That was the question in the heart of a pastor who was torn between the love of his country and the love of his God. Welcome back to the podcast. We're continuing our story on the life of Dietrich Bonhoeffer. You can go back and listen to our first episodes in this series to learn about the childhood of Dietrich, World War I, the time frame between the two world wars, and the rise of Hitler. Before we dive into today's story, a reminder, if you want to read a good book and you want to support this podcast, the best way to do both is to order one of my three books. The first one is The Church is Born, where we learn how Jesus started the church and how the church spread around the world. In our second book, we follow the church from the time of Constantine to the start of the Reformation, and we see how the church became corrupted slowly over time. My third book is a devotional book that looks at the story of the church through the songs we sing, called The Church Sings. You can check out those books today. Let's get into today's episode. June 14th, 1940. Imagine you're sitting in a crowded cafe, sipping coffee, and listening to the low murmur of conversations. Newspapers lie scattered across tables. Cigarette smoke hangs in the air. Outside, church bells ring in the distance. Then suddenly, the door bursts open. We've won! A man rushes inside, waving a newspaper above his head. France has surrendered! For a moment, there's silence. Then the room erupts. Chairs scrape across the floor as people leap to their feet. Men cheer. Women cry tears of relief. Strangers are embracing each other. The impossible has happened. Germany has defeated France. For many Germans, this is more than a military victory. Only 22 years earlier, Germany had suffered the humiliation of a defeat in World War I. They had endured poverty, hyperinflation, political chaos, and national shame. Now, it feels as though Germany has risen through the ashes. People begin singing patriotic songs, and someone starts shouting, "Heil Hitler." Others immediately join in, "Heil Hitler." Soon the entire cafe is echoing with the chant. Arms shoot into the air in Nazi salutes. But you remain seated. Your heart is conflicted. You love Germany. You want German soldiers to come home alive. You want your nation to prosper. You want the years of suffering to end. But you also know what Hitler has done. You know about the churches being controlled, the pastors being arrested, the Jewish families who are disappearing. You want Germany to succeed, but you don't want Hitler to succeed. And you wonder if anyone else in the room feels that same confusion. When your eyes catch sight of a familiar figure, standing near the back of a cafe is the pastor, Dietrich Bonhoeffer. You know him. Everybody knows him. The preacher who has challenged Hitler, the pastor who refused to bow to Nazi control of the church. The man is connected to the confessing church. And then you see him stand. His arm is raised. "Heil Hitler," he shouts along with the crowd. You stare in disbelief. What is happening? Has Dietrich finally given in? Has the pressure become too much? Has even Germany's most famous pastor chosen a side? Around you, the celebration grows louder. But something about Dietrich's face seems different. And before this day is over, you will discover not everything is as it appears. The scene sounds almost unbelievable today, but that really happened. On June 4th, 1940, Dietrich Bonhoeffer was sitting in a cafe when the news arrived that German troops had entered Paris. The victory was stunning. Only 5 weeks earlier, on May 10th, Germany had launched its attack against France, Belgium, Luxembourg, and the Netherlands. Military experts expected another long war of trenches and stalemates like the First World War. Instead, German forces moved with breathtaking speed. They bypassed the heavily fortified Magnet Line, swept through Armistice Forest, and trapped Allied armies before they could properly respond. The British army barely escaped at Dunkirk. More than 300,000 Allied soldiers had been evacuated across the English Channel in what many considered a miracle. And now Paris had fallen. For Germans, it felt impossible. The nation that had suffered defeat in 1918 had now conquered one of Europe's greatest powers in a matter of weeks. Church bells rang. Crowds flooded the streets. Strangers hugged one another. For millions of Germans, this was one of the happiest days of their lives. Within days, France would seek peace. An armistice would be signed on June 22nd. Northern France would fall under German occupation. Hitler appeared unstoppable. And it was at that very moment, when Hitler stood at the height of his popularity, that Dietrich made one of the most important decisions of his life. He did not suddenly become a Nazi. He did not stop believing that Hitler was leading Germany towards disaster. And he was not simply trying to fit in with the crowd. Rather, Dietrich realized that open opposition was no longer enough. For years, he had preached, he had warned, he had resisted publicly, and Hitler had only grown stronger. And now, another path was opening before him. A perhaps dark path. A path that would force him to ask questions he never imagined a Christian pastor would have to answer. Could a Christian participate in a conspiracy? Could a Christian deceive evil men? Could a Christian help overthrow a government? Could a Christian take part in a plot to kill a dictator? Dietrich didn't have all the answers yet, but he knew one thing. If he was going to help stop Hitler, he would need to access people on the inside. He would need the trust of military officers, government officials, and men who moved within the circles of power. And trusted men do not openly denounce the regime every day. So, while Germany celebrated its greatest military triumph in a generation, Dietrich quietly stepped into a secret world of resistance. The preacher who once fought Hitler from the pulpit was preparing to fight him from the shadows. To understand how shocking Dietrich's decision was, you have to understand who he had been only a year earlier. In 1939, Dietrich Bonhoeffer is one of the best-known critics of Hitler inside the German church. The Nazi government knew exactly who he was. For years, he had publicly criticized Nazi policies. He'd warned against making Hitler into a messiah. He had spoken out against racial discrimination. He had refused to allow the church to become a tool of the state. And as a result, the government had silenced him. First, he had been forbidden from speaking publicly. Then, he had been forbidden from publishing. His writings were censored. His movements were watched. Every year, the restrictions grew tighter. The Nazi government understood something important. Ideas are dangerous, and Dietrich's ideas were especially dangerous because they were wrapped in scripture. Now, not everyone in the church agreed with Dietrich. Some pastors argued that ministers should stay out of politics altogether. Just preach the gospel, they said. Stay out of government affairs. Politics is not the church's business. But Dietrich disagreed. He believed that there are moments when silence becomes a form of cooperation. If the government is attacking innocent people, corrupting the church, replacing truth with lies, a pastor cannot simply look the other way and claim he's remaining neutral. Meanwhile, other pastors moved in the opposite direction entirely. Rather than resisting Hitler, they embraced him. Nazi flags appeared inside the church buildings. Some pastors opened services with praises for the Führer. And German Christian movements taught that Christianity and Nazism belonged together. Large portions of the Old Testament were ignored because they were considered too Jewish. Even some of Paul's writings were treated with suspicion. Churches removed members of Jewish ancestry from their congregation and leadership positions. The church that had once proclaimed that all people are equal before the cross was now dividing people according to bloodlines. Dietrich could hardly believe what he was witnessing. Years earlier, he and other pastors had formed the Confessing Church in response to these changes. They had signed the Barnum Declaration. They had publicly declared Jesus Christ alone is Lord of the church. They had openly challenged Hitler's attempts to control Christianity, and because of that, they became targets. They were monitored, their publications were censored, the seminaries were closed, leaders were arrested. Every member of the Confessing Church knew the danger. And now, in 1940, Dietrich faced a reality he never would have imagined when he first entered ministry. Preaching against Hitler was no longer enough. The church had spoken, the government had not listened. And so the pastor, who spent years resisting openly, was about to step into a world of secrets, spies, conspiracies, and resistance. A world where every conversation would be dangerous. A world where one wrong word could mean prison or death. As Hitler's power grew, so did the darkness. Most Germans had no idea what was really happening. The newspapers only reported victories. The radio celebrated German greatness. Government officials spoke about security, order, national renewal. All of those were things that the average German should have been excited about. But behind the scenes, something more sinister was unfolding. Fortunately for Dietrich, his family occupied a unique position within German society. The Bonhoeffers were not outsiders. They were one of Germany's most respected families. For decades, they moved among the highest academic, legal, and government circles. They were professors, judges, lawyers, military officers, and civil servants trusted them. And because they blended in, they were able to see things that ordinary Germans could not. One of the most important people in Dietrich's life during these years was his brother-in-law, Hans. Hans was married to Dietrich's sister, Christine, and worked in the German government, first as a lawyer in the Ministry of Justice, and later in Germany's military intelligence service. Every day, reports crossed his desk. Official reports, secret reports, reports the public would never see. At first, the information was disturbing. Then it became horrifying. Jewish families were disappearing. Whole communities were being taken. Property was being seized. People were being arrested simply because of their ancestry. Unlike many government officials, Hans did not look away. He began secretly documenting everything. Names, dates, locations, orders, witness accounts, every scrap of evidence he could collect. As Germany conquered more territory across Europe, the reports multiplied. February 1940, German authorities deported approximately 1,000 Jews from eastern Germany cities and were sent into occupied Poland. April, Germany invaded Denmark and Norway. That same month, authorities sealed the first major Jewish ghetto. May, Germany invaded the Netherlands, Belgium, Luxembourg, and France. The SS established Auschwitz outside the Polish city. At the time, few people knew the name Auschwitz, but one day the entire world would know it. Summer arrived. Thousands of Jews were expelled from their home. Refugee camps appeared across Europe. Ghettos were created and families vanished. November, Germany authorities sealed the Warsaw Ghetto. More than 350,000 Jewish men, women, and children were crammed into tiny sections of the city, surrounded by walls and guards. The population would eventually approach 500,000 people. Hans read these reports, and then he shared them with Dietrich. Night after night, the men discussed what was happening. The evidence was becoming impossible to ignore. This was not just discrimination. This was not just persecution. This was extermination. The government was systematically removing an entire people group from European society, and they feared something even worse was coming. Together, Hans and Dietrich began quietly fighting back. They wrote reports documenting everything. They passed information to trusted military officers. Through church contacts and ecumenical connections, they shared information with people outside Germany. And they helped Jewish people escape. Jewish people were given false identities and disguised as intelligence agents. The operation became known as Operation 7. Lives were saved, but every rescue increased the danger. Every report could mean arrest. Every conversation could mean prison. Every act of resistance could mean death. For years, Diedrich had warned Germany that evil was growing. Now, he was seeing the evidence with his own eyes. And what he saw convinced him of something he never imagined he would believe. Hitler had to be stopped no matter the cost. Persecution of the Jewish people was the most visible evil of Hitler's regime. Everyone saw the signs. Jewish businesses simply disappeared. Jewish professors lost their job. Jewish families vanished from neighborhoods. The hatred was public. But another evil was growing quietly behind locked doors. An evil that many Germans never saw. An evil that struck some of Germany's most vulnerable citizens. And it began years before the war. In 1933, the Nazi government passed what was known as the Law for the Prevention of Hereditary Deceased Offspring. The name sounded scientific and harmless, but the law allowed the government to forcibly sterilize anybody with disabilities, mental illness, epilepsy, and any other condition the Nazis considered undesirable. Thousands lost the ability to have families. Then in 1939, things got darker. The Nazi government launched a secret program known as Arctian T4. The idea behind the program was terrifyingly simple. Certain people, the Nazis argued, were simply burdens on society. The disabled, the mentally ill, children with severe disabilities, adults living in institutions. These people, according to Nazi ideology, had lives that were simply not worth living. At first, doctors and nurses were ordered to report children under the age of 3 who had significant disabilities. Government officials then encouraged parents to place those children in special clinics where they would supposedly receive expert medical care. Parents were relieved. They believed their children were going to receive help. Instead, those clinics were killing centers. Children disappeared behind their walls, and weeks later, families would receive a letter. Their children, they were told, had died of pneumonia or heart failure or some sudden illness. The body had already been cremated. There was no funeral, no opportunity to see their loved ones, no questions were allowed. But the truth was, the children had been murdered. Then the program expanded. Instead of children, it became adults with disabilities. Buses with painted over windows quietly transported patients from hospitals and care homes to killing centers throughout Germany. Again, families received official notices. Again, they were told their loved ones had died of natural causes. Again, the bodies were already gone. The lies worked for a while, and many Germans began to suspect something was wrong, but nobody could prove it. But the reality of the program might have remained hidden if it wasn't for men like Hans. From his position inside the government, he gathered evidence, names, reports, orders, and death records, and he shared what he learned with Diedrich. The information shocked them both. The government was not merely persecuting political opponents or Jewish citizens. It was deciding which human lives were valuable and which were disposable. Together, Hans and Diedrich worked to get information out of Germany. Through church networks, foreign contracts, trusted friends in Britain and America, they helped expose what was happening behind closed doors. The numbers were staggering. Historians estimate that between 275 to 300,000 people were ultimately victims of the Nazi euthanasia programs. For Diedrich, this struck at the very heart of the gospel. The Nazi measured human worth by usefulness, health, productivity, and race. But Jesus Christ measured human worth differently. Every person was created in the image of God. The strong and the weak, the healthy and people with disabilities, the successful and the forgotten, all are equally valuable before their Creator. And once the government claims the power to decide whose life matters and whose life does not, there's almost no limit to the evil that will follow. By 1941, Diedrich had made his choice. For years, he had fought Hitler openly. He had preached against Nazi ideology. He had written against it. He had helped lead the Confessing Church in opposition to it. And where had that gotten him? Banned from speaking, banned from publishing, and watched by the Gestapo. The public fight was over. Now the battle would need to move into the shadows. Diedrich knew something most Germans did not. Reports coming from occupied Europe becoming worse every month. His brother-in-law Hans was still gathering evidence from inside the government, and together they were seeing the reality hidden behind the Nazi propaganda machine. As Germany conquered nation after nation, Jewish families completely disappeared, entire communities gone, ghettos sealed, concentration camps multiplied, and the evidence pointed toward something even more terrible, mass murder. Dietrich realized that simply preaching sermons would not stop what was coming, so he began working with members of the German resistance, Germany's military intelligence service. On paper, Dietrich looked like a loyal German working for military intelligence. In reality, he was helping undermine Hitler's government. The arrangement gave him something priceless. He now had freedom to travel, freedom to meet people, freedom to carry messages, and that's exactly what he did. Dietrich became a courier for the resistance. He traveled across Europe under the cover of official businesses, while secretly meeting church leaders, diplomats, and trusted contacts. He carried information from the resistance to foreign governments and brought information back. His mission was simple but dangerous: convince Britain and America that not all Germans supported Hitler. There were Germans fighting from within, Germans trying to stop the madness. Germans were willing to risk everything to overthrow the Nazi regime. At the same time, Dietrich and Hans became involved in helping Jewish people escape. Under the rescue effort known as Operation 7, Jews were secretly disguised as agents and smuggled out of Germany into neutral countries, and every forged document carried a risk. Every time they crossed a border, there was more risk. Every rescue carried risk. If it was discovered, everyone involved would be executed for treason. Yet Dietrich continued. But even as he worked to save lives and pass information to Britain and America, a darker question haunted him. What if the information wasn't enough? What if the rescue operations weren't enough? What if diplomacy failed? What if the only way to stop Hitler was to remove him? Years earlier, Dietrich had believed that a Christian should never participate in violence. Now he found himself sitting in secret meetings with men discussing assassination. It's important to understand, this was not because they hated Germany. They loved Germany deeply. They wanted to save Germany. They wanted to save Europe. They wanted to save millions of innocent lives. The pastor who once stood in a pulpit preaching about discipleship was now wrestling with one of the most difficult questions. What does a Christian do when evil has become the government himself? By now, Dietrich was living a double life. To the outside world, he appeared to have changed. He traveled under the authority of the government. He moved among military officers. He attended meetings with powerful people. He even appeared to support government policies he privately despised. After all, that's what spies do. A spy survives by living undercover. Many of Dietrich's friends had no idea what was happening. They remembered the young pastor who had boldly preached against Hitler, the man who had challenged the Nazi takeover of the church, the leader of the confessing church. Now they saw him working alongside government officials. They were shocked. They were hurt. They felt betrayed. Had Dietrich compromised? Had the pressure broken him? Had he become one of them? Dietrich couldn't defend himself because the truth was too dangerous. The fewer people who knew about the resistance, the safer everyone would be. So he carried the burden silently, while some of his closest friends questioned his faithfulness. Even among those who knew his secret, there were disagreements. Many believed he should continue speaking publicly against Hitler. After all, wasn't that what a pastor was supposed to do? Stand for truth? Preach courageously? Denounce evil? Dietrich did understand that argument. In fact, he had spent years doing exactly that. But he had also watched what happened to those who continued resisting openly. One by one, they disappeared. Pastors were arrested. Church leaders were imprisoned. Members of the confessing church were interrogated and sent to concentration camps. Men like Martin Mueller had become symbols of resistance, but from prison cells, they could no longer organize, travel, gather intelligence, or help overthrow the regime. Dietrich feared that public resistance alone was becoming exactly what Hitler wanted. Every pastor arrested was one less opponent. every leader imprisoned weakened the resistance. And while brave men were sitting in concentration camps, Hitler continued conquering Europe. By 1941, much of the continent lay under Nazi control. France had fallen, Poland had fallen, the Netherlands, Belgium, Denmark, Norway, falling. The map of Europe seemed to change every month. Dietrich feared what would happen if no one stopped Hitler. How many more countries would fall? How many more Jewish families would disappear? How many more churches would surrender? How many more lives would be lost? From his perspective, sitting in a concentration camp might be noble, but it did nothing to stop Hitler. And if Hitler was not stopped, Europe would be lost. So, Dietrich accepted the criticism. He accepted the suspicion. He accepted that some people misunderstood him. The mission was not to save his reputation. The mission was to stop Hitler. And that meant remaining free long enough to make a difference. So when Germany occupied France in 1940, Dietrich made a decision that few people around him understood. He would look like he had changed sides. He did it because he believed that getting close to the regime gave him the best chance to stop it. If trusted military officers and government officials believed he was loyal, then he could gather information. If he could gather information, he could pass it to Britain in America. And if that failed, then he would help remove Hitler by force, perhaps even kill him. That sentence still shocks people today. Dietrich Bonhoeffer, a pastor, a man who preached the Sermon on the Mount, a man who taught about following Christ, a man who spent years wrestling with Jesus' command to love your enemies, found himself discussing assassination because he had become convinced that every month Hitler remained in power meant thousands more innocent people were going to die. And the evidence kept arriving. Jewish families kept disappearing. Children being murdered through the euthanasia program. Pastors arrested. Nations occupied. The killing was accelerating. Dietrich concluded that allowing Hitler to continue might be a moral failure. So he entered the resistance more deeply. Between 1941 and 1942, he became connected to a growing network of military officers, lawyers, intelligent agents, church leaders who secretly opposed Hitler, many of them working through government's military intelligence service. Officially, Dietrich worked for the military intelligence. Unofficially, he was helping undermine the government from within, carrying messages between the resistant workers, traveling under the cover of intelligent work. He met with the church leaders and foreign contacts. He passed information to trusted people outside of Germany. He rescued Jews from Nazi persecution. In the next chapter of Dietrich's life, another surprise awaits him. In the middle of war, espionage, and assassination plots, Dietrich Bonhoeffer would fall deeply in love. And while planning for a future he hoped to build, he would become involved in one of the most daring conspiracies of the entire war, a plot to blow up Adolf Hitler. And that is where we will continue the story next time. Before we judge the Germans of 1942 harshly, we should pause and look carefully at ourselves. It's easy to read history and wonder how could they allow that to happen? How could ordinary people ignore the persecution of their neighbors? How could they remain silent while innocent lives were being taken? How could churches fail to speak clearly when evil stood before them? But the uncomfortable truth is that every generation faces its own moral test. The Nazis hid much of their euthanasia program because they knew many Germans would be horrified if they understood what was happening. Families were lied to. Death certificates were falsified. The truth was buried behind secrecy and propaganda. But today, we don't face the same situation in the same way. Christians still find themselves wrestling with questions about the value of human life. Here in Canada, euthanasia has become a leading cause of death and is available for people with disabilities. And while Hitler had made his euthanasia program a secret, Canadian is doing it all publicly. Not only is it open, it's celebrated by most Canadians. As Christians, we know that Scripture teaches us that every human being is created in the image of God and possesses inherent dignity and worth, regardless of age, ability, health, or productivity. As followers of Jesus Christ, we have to think carefully, biblically, and compassionately as we defend the vulnerable and as we care for those who are suffering. We also see growing concerns about anti-Semitism. Across Canada, Jewish communities have reported vandalism, threats, harassment, attacks against synagogues, schools, and community institutions. Jewish professors and Jewish doctors are leaving Canada because they're no longer safe. These realities should concern every Christian. Why? Dietrich's story reminds us that hatred rarely begins with violence. It begins with words, stereotypes, scapegoating, or the belief that one group of people is responsible for society's problems. And when enough people stay silent, that hatred will grow. The lesson in Dietrich Bonhoeffer is not simply that Germans got it wrong. The lesson is that every generation has to decide whether it will courageously defend truth and human dignity when it becomes unpopular to do so. The church's calling is not to follow the crowd. It's to follow Christ, to defend the vulnerable, to speak truth with love, to reject hatred when it appears, and to remember that every person, Jew, Gentile, able-bodied or disabled, rich or poor, is made in the image of God. History is most useful when it helps us examine our own hearts. The question is not only, what would I have done in Germany in 1940? The question is, what am I doing today? If you enjoyed today's episode, make sure to subscribe on YouTube or your favorite podcast app so you don't miss an episode. We release new content every Monday. And don't forget to check out our website at loraleesiemens.com for more information and additional resources. Thanks for listening, and we'll see you next week as we continue our journey through the incredible history of the church.